Good morning, Hope. Good to see you this morning. I almost said evening there. It's not evening. My name's Davis. If I haven't had a chance to meet you, I'm one of the pastors here at the downtown location. And as we get started, I want you to think of the last time you gave someone instructions. Maybe it's a roommate. Maybe if you're a parent, you gave instructions to your kid, like, this is what I want you to do. Maybe you're a kid and you gave instructions to your parents. Here's where I live now. Here's how you get there. And perhaps you felt a little bit like this meme from the Men in Black. Every time I give instructions, it's like the neuralizer is used. And everything I just said is now forgotten. Or maybe you're on the receiving end of instructions. And you're a little bit like Tim the Tool Man. And you think, well, at the end of the day, what are instructions? It's just the opinion of the manufacturer, right? Or how about advice or instruction that is not solicited? Right? If somebody offers you their opinion of, here's what you should do, like this pie chart on unsolicited parenting advice. 50% of me says, how much do I like it? Not at all. The other 50% of it says, how much do I like it? Not at all, but in red. Right? A lot of memes on unsolicited parenting advice. People don't want that, apparently. Who knew? Why am I talking about this? Well, today, our passage in Ephesians, we are going to be looking at instructions, and maybe you might call it unsolicited instructions. You didn't know you were coming in here today to be told about work and relationships, but ultimately, I'm hopeful that we'll see the way that God gives instructions is not like us. In fact, there's always something more going on beneath his instructions that's meant to be heard differently than the way we might give instructions to one another. And if you are just joining us for the first time, this is kind of part two of a message that was given last week based on this idea in chapter 5 of Ephesians, which is to submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Pastor Steve walked us through the application of this idea with regards to marriage. And today we're going to be looking at this idea in light of relationships as well as work. And I'm excited to see what God might do with his word for us this morning. So if you do have a Bible with you, I encourage you to open Ephesians chapter 6. This is the second to last message, actually, in our walking through the book of Ephesians. One of our elders named Tosh is going to walk us through the last chapter next week. So Ephesians chapter 6, 1 through 9 is what we're going to be looking at today. Let me read it for us. It says this, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may go well with you and that you may enjoy long life on the earth. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and the instruction of the Lord. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear and with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ. Obey them not only to win their favor when their eye is on you, but as slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from your heart. Serve wholeheartedly as if you were serving the Lord, not people, because you know that the Lord will reward each one for whatever good they do, whether they are slave or free. And masters, treat your slaves in the same way. Do not threaten them, since you know that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no favoritism with him. If you do like to have a little bit of a roadmap or more type A inclined, this is very briefly where we're going to go this morning. I just want to hear the instruction, kind of the what is the instruction for both children and parents, as well as servants and masters. But then I also want to ask this question, why? Why is it here? And more specifically, why is it phrased this way? I think that's where things really come to life when engaging God's word, is just asking questions of it and trying to make sense of why it would be said the way that it is. And then at the end, I just want to close with, how are we actually going to do this? What does this actually look like in real life? So what, why, and how is where I want to take us this morning. Beginning with the children. I love this because right out of the gate, we learn that all people matter to God, even in this very simple statement. Children, obey your parents in the Lord. Commentators are pretty unanimous in being surprised by this being here. or allowing this to be surprising to us, because Paul is addressing within the whole church. He's saying, actually, you children, I have something for you as well. Even those who are just kids, you matter and you have a role to play in this community. And especially in the first century, this would be something that was that is meant to be like, whoa, we got to treat these people as human beings. So that's the first thing just to see. It's like, whoa, that's interesting that that children themselves are being addressed in the congregation. But the idea behind obeying your parents is actually anchored in the fact that it's right and that God's word says so in the Old Testament, to actually honor your father and your mother. And what's fascinating about this command in the Old Testament, which we're going to talk a lot about when we're thinking about why is this here, but this idea of honoring your father and your mother is something that remains through time for you, for your good. But how you apply it to your life does evolve with time. When you live in the household with your parents, it looks one way. It looks like children obeying your parents, submitting to them out of reverence for Christ. Then as you move on in life and you might move out of the house, that relationship begins to change. And especially in a church of our makeup, we have a lot of young adults here. And I know a lot of us are learning, what does this actually look like now? As a young adult or as an adult, what does it look like to honor my father and my mother? And I found a biblical counselor named Laura McKee and a sister church of ours through the network of X29 who says this about the idea of honoring your parents as a young adult. She says four things about what this looks like as you transition from being in the household to in the working world. She says the first thing to recognize is it looks like listening and respecting your parents' opinion. I'm going to read that again because you're already reading 2, 3, and 4. It looks like listening and respecting your parents' opinion. You're forming a lot of your own opinions now in this phase in your life. And so it's easy to just look at all of their flaws and dismiss them and not hear what they have to say. But that doesn't look like honoring and respecting your parents. Instead, listen and respect what they have to say. Two, she says, communicate honestly with them. The parent-child relationship, especially as you become an adult, is one that is tense emotionally. You're aware of all of their flaws, they're aware of all of your flaws, and what it looks like to now walk alongside them is something that takes time. And one of the best ways to learn that is to communicate openly and honestly about where you're at, and to also talk about the past, not to airbrush it, but to learn how to even offer forgiveness as they do the same to you. The third point is, she says, realize it's okay to just, you can disagree with your parents as you become an adult. You can make your own decisions. And then this last one, I think this is one of the most profound things she says in the article, is she says, as you're becoming your own adult and you're moving on from living in the household with your parents, that relationship actually starts to look more like the way the Old Testament describes loving your neighbor, treating them with dignity and honor and loving them as you would love yourself. But now they take more of a peer role and you begin to develop a new relationship with them. So I appreciate a lot of what the rest of the article has to say. If you have more questions about that, I encourage you to read Laura's words. So children, obey your parents. That's the first what instruction we have. The second now is actually for parents. It says fathers. The Greek word actually there could be translated either fathers or both parents. Do not exasperate your children, Paul says. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. Some of your translations might actually say, don't provoke your children. Elsewhere in the New Testament, when Paul brings up this idea about the way parents are to raise their children, he says, you're ultimately actually after their heart. You're not just to tell them, here's all the things you need to do. You need to be involved in their lives in such a manner that you learn the way they respond to your instruction. Not to coddle them, but to learn, this is what my child is like, and these are the things that really grind his or her gears. These are the things that really stress them out. Not provoking your children also includes the idea of not showing favoritism, being consistent in the way that we might discipline as parents. The list goes on and on, but Paul's instruction to parents here is to take seriously that your kid is a human being who works the same way you do, who doesn't like unsolicited advice on things. So learn the way that your kid might respond to instruction. And that second piece, bring them up in the training and the instruction of the Lord. Oyewale Akande writes for the Gospel Coalition about this verse, and I love what he describes. He says, your children should know that you would like them to do well in school. It's a good thing to know. But they should also know that for you, the most important thing they can do is develop their relationship with God. And he quotes some scriptures on that, including our passage today. Often, the real problem is that the distinction is not very clear in our own minds about what ultimately is our highest priority in raising up kids. So this means it won't be clear in our children's minds either. What are those things that are being prioritized in the household? He goes on. Spiritual growth has to be clearly more important than academic performance or fill in the blank on any other thing. He says, this is the thing that needs to rise to the top, be preeminent in the way that we might instruct and raise children, not only in our own households, but also as a church family. We must drive away this fog from our thoughts and let our children know that following God is more important and rewarding than any trinkets they may win in this fallen world. The idea of spiritual growth is to be at the center of the way that we think about the priorities within the household and what it looks like to learn the hearts of our children. Again, both within the household and within the church. So this is the what. Children and parents, children obey your parents. Parents, instruct your children in the Lord and don't provoke them. Don't exasperate them. There's a lot more that could be said about the what, but I again really want us to think about the why. Why is this here and what might God have for us in this? And the way to do this is to often just slow down. Look at what's being quoted and look at where our attention is being drawn out. And especially for the instruction for the children, what's quoted here is fascinating. And it's meant to be thought-provoking. It's meant to slow us down and help us ask questions. What are you doing here, Paul? And ultimately, what are you doing here, God? What do you have to say? And why are you quoting this the way you are? So he actually is quoting the Ten Commandments from Exodus 20, verse 12. We're told, honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. Now, I love what Klein Snodgrass, who has the most epic biblical commentator name ever, maybe. Klein Snodgrass says this about any time you hear ethics or instructions in the Bible, Paul and every other author does not merely adopt the society's instructions to these groups, wherever they're writing. It's not just, okay, what's the culture doing? We'll say the same thing. Rather, he always laces his instructions with theological motivations, just as he did in treating other ethical issues. What's he saying here? Anytime you hear an instruction or anything that sounds like advice in the Bible, anywhere you're reading it, there's always something deeper going on beneath the surface. There's always something more to be drawn out by simply asking the question why or how or what does this actually even mean? And here, I think something fascinating is happening. Because if we go back to Exodus 20 and we read the Ten Commandments of Moses telling Israel what to do, only six verses later, like the same page, just like let your eyes just fall a little bit down the page, we watch how God's people respond to this instruction. The first time this instruction is given, how do the people respond? Not well. Read with me Exodus 20, 18, 19. It says, when the people saw the thunder and the lightning and they heard the trumpet and they saw the mountain in smoke, they got so excited and they were ready to listen to what God, no. It's the opposite. They trembled with fear. They stayed at a distance and they said to Moses, speak to us yourself and we will listen, but do not have God speak to us or we will die. So as Paul is offering instruction to us today, he's quoting a scene where this was first given and the response of the people was fear and trembling and the feeling of, if God keeps talking, I'm a dead man. Moses, you need to tell God to shut up and you tell us what to do because if this instruction is too heavy for us to bear. Later in the story of the Old Testament, this idea of instruction at a mountain is kind of recaptured, but it's almost utter opposite. We have people coming in to hear instruction from the Lord, but it looks the exact it looks night and day different than what we have here in Exodus 20. And this is in Isaiah 2. This is a prophet talking about the future when sometime some people will actually want to hear what God has to say. It says this, in the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills and all nations will stream to it. many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. And here it is. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. Did you catch the difference? In Exodus 20, the people are hearing and they're staying at a distance and they're closing their ears to God saying, we don't want to hear this instruction. It's too much for us to bear. But at some point in the future, Isaiah prophesies that there will be a time when not just Israel, but all nations in the presence of God's instruction will not hide and stand at a distance, will not want to hear it. They'll actually come and they'll say, teach us, God, your ways. Tell us what you're like. With an eager heart, we want to hear what it is that God has to say. So what stands in between these two mountains, from staying at a distance in fear to wanting to draw near and hear instruction with a glad heart? The difference is always found in the mystery. Trike last week preached about the mystery of God that has been hidden for ages and has now been made clear in the person and work of Christ. And this has everything to do with the way we think about a man and a woman coming together in marriage. And he quoted Paul Thielman in Making Sense of This Mystery. And I just want to read this quote again. It's so good. The union of husband and wife in one flesh was originally intended to prefigure and to illustrate the union of Christ, the union that Christ now has with the church. It is a mega meaning great mystery because it is unusually mysterious. Love that. Unusually mysterious. The adjective megas appears to express the greatness of the degree to which the thing or person is what it is. A great mystery is especially mysterious. How many ways can we say mystery? A lot of ways. The application of Genesis 2, all the way back in the Old Testament, when man and woman were first made, to the union of Christ with the church would be nonsensical. It wouldn't make any sense apart from a special revelation from God that tells of this application. What's he saying here? A lot of language about the mystery. The mega mystery, the big idea that God has kept veiled for thousands of years in the Old Testament, is that it's always been about Christ and what Christ was going to do. And so anytime we encounter something that looks one way and then it's going to look the utter opposite, what stands in the middle is this mega mystery. And we can't just arrive at that conclusion ourselves by studying hard. It has to, as is said here, be a special revelation from God. We have to hear God say, this is the mystery. This is the big idea. This is the thing I've kept hidden for thousands of years that I can't wait to tell you about. And this mystery is Jesus. This mystery is Jesus coming to earth. This mystery is me as God putting on human flesh and coming to earth to do what you could not do and to bear the weight of that penalty that Israel felt when they said, God needs to stop talking to us lest we die. We are not living up to these expectations that God has. The great mystery is Christ himself. This is how Paul elaborates on it in Colossians. He says this, I have become the church's servant by the commission God gave me to present to you the word of God in its fullness. The mystery that has been kept hidden for ages and generations, but is now disclosed to the Lord's people. To them, God has chosen to make known among the Gentiles the glorious riches of this mystery. And here is the mystery. The mystery is that you can have God in you through the person and work of Christ. This is the mystery. Christ in you, the hope of glory, the hope of eternity spent with your Maker because of the finished work of Jesus on the cross in your place. The mystery inserts itself and stands between these two mountains and changes the narrative to be all about Jesus. It's so surprising. And it reminds me of one of the strangest ways I recently had some entertainment, going to see a musical. Not priority number one on my entertainment bucket list, but it was my wife's birthday. And so we went and saw a musical. And we went to a high school theater for this musical, and it was a high school level of production. I won't say where, but it definitely presented itself as a high school level production when twice, not once, but twice, the music went out in the background, right? They're singing and all of a sudden the music stops and you watch the actors and they're like, uh-oh. And the first time that happened, you weren't really sure. Like it was done in such a way where you're like, I think something went wrong there, but they were able to cover it up well enough where you're like, maybe not. But the second time, it was right as they were crescendoing into the climax of the song, just one singer, and the music just cuts out, silence. And if, yeah, oh no, if you're sitting in the crowd, your blood pressure just rises in this moment, right? Like, for some reason, all of a sudden, you're inserting yourself in their place, and you're going back to all the nightmares you've ever had of being on stage. And your heart is just pumping, and the tension in the room is thick, and we're all feeling it, and then something amazing happened. This lead actress in this play, didn't miss a beat. Instead, she stepped forward and just filled the room and kept singing a cappella. It was like she took us to another atmosphere with her voice, and the crowd just goes bananas afterwards. Probably from the sense of relief of like, oh God, we're okay, we're gonna make it through this. But it was amazing. I mean, there are people whistling and hollering and cheering, and it was the highlight of the night for everybody in the show. And in fact, the show kind of changed from there. Every time she got on the stage, we were all like, do it again, right? Like, we're just, you're so good. And this play became forever, at least in my book, I don't know about yours, it became about her. It was her talent put on display, and it was in the midst of the failure. I don't know if it was an individual behind the scenes or just the low budget production that a high school show can do, but because of this failure, this something more beautiful is now experienced by everyone in the crowd. And that's a lot like what the Bible is constantly doing. It looks like it's setting something up here, us receiving instruction that we might do it, so that God can interrupt it with something so much more beautiful that's surprising and puts us at ease, brings relief, not by anything we've done, but by everything Christ has done. This is the mega mystery of God, that it's all about Jesus. It's not about us. Here, Hebrews unpacking the difference between these two mountains and what stands in the middle of them. The author of Hebrews says, you have not come to a mountain that looks like Sinai. He says, a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm. You have not come to a trumpet blast or to such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them, because they could not bear what was commanded. If even an animal touches this mountain, it must be stoned to death. The sight was so terrifying that it wasn't just Israel closing the ears. Moses himself said, I am trembling with fear. But what have you come to? You've come to an utterly different mountain, one that looks like the mountain that was prophesied about in Isaiah. You have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly. Just think about that image. You've come to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect. You have come to Jesus, the great mystery, and the mediator of a new covenant, one that does not look like the old, one that does not look like Mount Sinai, of you hearing what to do, and you standing on your own performance of how well you do at that. Instead, you've come to a mountain that covers you with sprinkled blood, that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. The blood of Abel spoke a word of justice towards you, but the blood of Jesus speaks a word of kindness and grace that says your penalty has been paid in full. Jesus is the mega mystery that stands in the middle of these two mountains. And it's a message for you that we might hear instruction in light of an Isaiah 2-like mountain. And even as we hear this instruction this morning, does your hearing it look more like Exodus, where you kind of want to close your ears? Either in fear or in just disregard. You can't tell me what to do, right? Like that's ultimately what hearing instruction at Mount Sinai looks like. I am my own authority. Or do you hear this instruction this morning with a heart that says, teach me, God. Instruct me in your ways. Your ways are life-giving and they're meant for my good. Not for my salvation, but for my joy. So this is the why behind what I think Paul is doing here. They're, just like in Ephesians 5, like Trike walked us through last week, we hear that it's explicitly we hear, this is a profound mystery when I'm talking about marriage. It's Christ and the church. Even though it's not explicitly stated here in the New Testament, it's always implied or assumed. In fact, we're reading in light of Ephesians 5, so we ought to pull that profound mystery into the way we understand these words. Same thing kind of goes for the instructions to parents. In fact, I got a friend, his name is Noel Hakenin. He kind of oversees our Midwest churches in Acts 29, and we call him the bearded bishop. You can see why. He is smiling in this photo, but you can't see it because of that beard. That's just a Santa beard. It's like Noel the Gray here. It's gotten a lot wider since then. Now he's Noel the bearded bishop of the white. He says, parenting is the same as the gospel. Think about this, applying the mountain idea to the way we parent. We move from law to grace. When kids are little, we start with the law. And as they get older, we move to grace. It's easy in parenting. And in fact, he goes, most rebellious kids have parents that get this backwards. When they are little, their parents laugh off their disobedience. Then when they are rebellious teenagers, they clamp down on the law to make up for it. I like this picture here of the way that Paul was describing, again, raising up your kids in the instruction of the Lord. How does God raise us up? It begins with law so that we can see what is right and good, and then we can recognize how often we fail and we need something better. And parents are able to demonstrate that big story of God even in the way that we parent. So that's the what and why for children and parents. Again, it's putting on display this mega mystery, this profound mystery that God has been so eager and interested in telling us that we can't hear enough of and that we can apply to every situation, to every relationship we're a part of. Now he moves on to servants and masters. And then again, let's read what Paul has to say in its entirety. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear and with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ. Obey them, not only to win their favor when their eye is on you, but as slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from your heart. Serve wholeheartedly, as if you were serving the Lord, not people, because you know that the Lord will reward each one whatever good they do, whether slave or free. Now, there's something that happens when we read this as a 21st century American, or as an American, that when we hear the concept of slaves and masters, our minds are quick to jump to the realities of the transatlantic slave trade and all of its atrocities. And our stomach probably moves into a knot and our blood pressure raises, a little bit like watching somebody make a mistake on stage, right? Like that play. And I first just want to say, your stomach should be in knots if you think of the transatlantic slave trade, because it's horrible. And we should never gloss over the past, but we should look at it with clear eyes and reckon with the history of our country. What we should also hear when we're reading the scriptures and the idea of slaves and masters are coming up, it actually isn't in light of our country's past. It's instead, it was written at a time where slavery and the concept of it looked different than our country's history. It didn't look like chattel slavery. Tim Keller's helpful on this. He says this, Paul is speaking to servants and masters, and this raises many questions in the minds of modern readers about the Bible's depiction of the evil of slavery. While much can be said about this subject, it is important to remember that slavery in the Greco-Roman world was not the same as the New World institution that developed in the wake of the African slave trade. Slavery in Paul's time was not race-based, and it was seldom lifelong. It was more like what we would call indentured servitude. And he goes on to describe what this looked like. You had people in all echelons of society who might be indebted to one another for a season where they served in their household or on their property. And it was not lifelong, and it wasn't based on race. It was actually based on some form of a debt. And you had doctors, teachers, all just a whole spectrum of people who would actually serve in this role. And it was a servant-type relationship, and a lot of them had an income as a result of it. But Tim Keller goes on, and he says something that I think we ought to hear as we listen to what Paul's instruction is for us. For our purposes, think of this passage as a rhetorical amplifier. And consider this, if slave owners are told they must not manage workers in pride and through fear, how much more should this be true of employers today? And if slaves are told it is possible to find satisfaction and meaning in their work, regardless of their work, how much more should this be true of workers today? I love this application of what we're looking at in this instruction, and it makes us think of our own jobs, right? And there's a good chance that you fall on the spectrum somewhere between Jim and Dwight in the way that you think about your job, right? Either my work is utterly purposeless. All the knowledge that I have about paper serves me no good in life, right? That's Jim's approach to work. And then you have Dwight on the complete other opposite end of the spectrum, which is everything I do is who I am, right? I'm assistant regional manager, to which you might say assistant. Wow, this is, we like TV in this group. Yes, we do. And there's a good chance, like you might lean more towards Jim in one season, you might lean more towards Dwight in another, but you engage in your work, all of us engage in our work with some form of a me-centered approach to what I am doing and what I'm accomplishing. And what Paul has here is astounding and profound and unbelievably helpful for even the way you go about your job tomorrow. The way you think about who is it that I'm ultimately serving? Is it an employer? Is it myself? Both of those things are going to suffocate your soul and not lead to the satisfaction and the fulfillment that God actually has designed for every one of us in the way that we approach work. Look again at his words. Obey your employer, obey anyone who you're working for or serving, not only to win their favor when their eye is on you. What does that look like? Remember my previous job, I'd often get in early before everyone else did, just so that when someone came in, they'd see me working. They'd be like, oh man, that guy's a hard worker. That's just when their eye is on me. That's all I want. I just wanted someone to think, he's a hard worker. It didn't matter what I was doing. I was probably just playing a game. That's still true today. That's why I get in here so early. That's what it looks like when their eye is on you. Even in the way we email. I was thinking about, this passage was just turning in my mind this week and I was sending an email. And I'm going, why am I saying it this way? Why am I making this about me and trying to sound impressive? That's such a dumb way to approach work. But what Paul is giving us is something so much more. Don't do that just as when people's eye are on you, when their eyes are on you. Recognize that you're a slave of Christ. Do the will of God from your heart and find a new form of satisfaction and joy in the work that you're doing. Serve wholeheartedly as if you were serving the Lord, not people. And for those of us who are in a position where we're actually serving in some organization, this text can be applied in a myriad number of ways. But even beyond this, this text has actually everything to say with how we approach anything in life, any task. Listen to our guy, Klein Snodgrass, again. He says, the message of this text obviously moves from ancient slavery to modern employer-employee relations. But it pushes us far beyond that. Its theology concerns who we really are at the end of the day. What motivates us? Whom we seek to please, and how we use power, which is something we're going to talk a little bit more about in a second. Every part of life is redefined. No action or relation is seen by itself, and nothing is treated at merely surface level. Everything we do involves a direct encounter with Jesus Christ. Let me say that again. Every single thing we do involves a direct encounter with Jesus Christ. This is certainly how Jesus saw the world when he walked it before he died. He said this, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me. Elsewhere, the New Testament is described, whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, do it all for the glory of God, recognizing that all that we do is an opportunity to connect with the God who made us, the God who loves us, the God who died for us and rose again and is now alive and active in our world. So whether you're doing the dishes, whether you're cleaning up after kids, whether you're going to school, do it all wholeheartedly, recognizing that none of what your position in life is contingent upon how well you do that thing. And everything is about the one who came and died for you. But the passage goes on. It doesn't just stop with servants, employees, and the tasks that we do. Instead, it moves to masters. It says, and masters, treat your slaves in the same way. Do not threaten them, since you know that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no favoritism with him. There is so much that we could say about this passage. Let me just say a few things. One, this is utterly astounding what Paul is saying and how he's now seeing authority in light of the gospel. And if you ever lord yourself over someone by position of status or authority, then you're directly undoing the relationship of the gospel and how it's meant to affect our work. More than this, Paul is saying that threatening is now off the table. We are no longer allowed to use fear or power in such a way that says, I'm over you and you have to do this. Why? Because I said so. Instead, you are on level playing field with these individuals. And some people would say that about the very institution of slavery, what Paul is doing here is not taking a full frontal assault on it, because that never works in the long run. Instead, he's doing more of a Star Wars, drop the torpedo into the vent of the Death Star and taking it out from the middle, right? Taking it out from the inside. That one was for you, Chris. A little Star Wars analogy. But think about that. For ages, it's not just slavery that he's after, though that is something that is now imploded from the inside, because what is slavery built upon but threats and fear? This also has everything to say about the way we think about power and the way we think about our status over and against someone. In fact, power is something that we often think about either intangibly or tangibly, and this passage in particular wants us to consider the way God thinks about power. And Martin Luther had a concept that he called right-handed and left-handed power that I think is profound. And Robert Capon is the guy who's expounded on this. That's taught me a lot. And I want to share some of those of his findings or his thoughts on it. He says this: right-handed power, use the force you need to get the result you want. That's the way we think about it, just right-handed power, just logic. Might makes right. Set out to do something and you'll get it done. Use the force you need to get the result you want. Is responsible for almost everything that happens in the world. And the beauty of it is, it works. From removing the dust with a cloth to removing your enemy with a 45, punchy language, it achieves its ends in sensible, effective, easily understood ways, right? Any time that we just set out to just do something and we tell someone what to do, or we ourselves just do it, it's just, here's what I need to do, and I'm going to take care of it. I'm going to get it done. That's right-handed power, okay? Unfortunately, it has a whopping limitation. If you take the view that one of our chief objects in life is to remain in loving relationships with other people, straight line or right-handed power becomes useless. Think back on all the relationship stuff we were just looking at. When you've told someone, you need to do this thing. Why? Because I said you need to do it. It's a form of right-handed power. You have to do this. And what does it do to that relationship? It almost always inevitably creates distance. It almost always drives a wedge that says, now we're at a little bit of a distance. This looks more like Sinai than it does Zion. He goes on, the ministry of Jesus, taken in its entirety, is the manifestations of God's deep preference for a left-handed, mysterious, there's that idea again, exercise of, in fact, power. It looks for all the world like weakness, not strength. More than that, it is guaranteed to stop no determined evildoers, whatsoever. It might, of course, touch and soften their hearts, but then again, it might not. It certainly didn't for Jesus. And if you decide to use it, you should be quite clear that it probably won't for you either. The only thing that it does ensure is that you will not, even after your chin has been bashed in, have made the mistake of closing any interpersonal doors from your side. Lastly, he says, which may not at first glance seem like an exercise worthy of the name of power. We might not call that power. Why? It looks like weakness. But when you come to think of it, it is power. So much power, in fact, that it is the only thing in the world that evil can't touch. God in Christ died for giving. With the dead body of Jesus, he wedged open the door between himself and the world and said, there, just try and get me to take that back. It's a visceral image that he's saying here that's meant to draw our attention up to the ultimate relationship that we have to God, and how in our not being able to get to him because of our falling short, Jesus opened the door and put himself in between the distance and said, I'm never taking this back. The way that I'm going to even take over the world is going to be upside down now, because my form of power is always surprising, because it always looks like weakness. It always looks like absorbing the blow on behalf of another. And it might not win in the short term. In fact, usually it doesn't. But in the grand scheme of things, it is the only thing that evil can't overcome. It can't supersede what Jesus is ultimately doing with left-handed power. So in light of all of this, how can we actually do this? What at the end of the day am I to go out and now do? How am I to think about all of this instruction? And to answer this question, I want to rely on theologian Dr. Strange in light of the new movie, Dr. Strange 2, which I won't offer my opinion on Because if I say I like it, you're going to email me because of all the bad stuff in it. But if I say I don't like it, I'll be lying. So I'm not going to tell you what I think of that movie. But I want to quote the first movie in order to avoid spoiling anything. At the end of the movie, his sensei, who he calls the Ancient One, is kind of giving her last like pep talk to him, right? It's the last time she's going to have something to say to him. And it's this profound teaching moment where she says, "You always excelled, but not because you craved success. It was because you feared failure." And Dr. Strange does what Dr. Strange always does. He interrupts and he's like, "I'm the best." And he says, "It's what made me a great doctor." And she said, "It's precisely what kept you from greatness. Because you missed the simplest and most significant message." And he's kind of dumbfounded. He says, "Which is?" And she says, "It's not about you. Your life, this instruction from God, all of this is not ultimately about you." Look again at the passage and all the places that God is trying to tell us that. It's not about you. Your very life is not about you. Your relationships, your work, they're all part of something so much greater, namely the mega mystery of God, Jesus Christ, who's constantly wanting to tell the world about himself, but he's never doing it from a position of need. He's always doing it from a position of generosity. And the context of your relationships, your work, everything you do is an opportunity to put him on display and to find your own sense of satisfaction and joy in the Lord of the universe. So as we come to a close, I just want to ask you, where is God inviting you to let the gospel reshape your approach to work and relationships this week? Where is God inviting you to see left-handed power instead of right-handed? Where is God inviting you to see Jesus in place of us to find our true sense of fulfillment? In a moment, I'm going to pray, and then we're all going to be invited to join the worship team in song and come forward and take from the table. The bread represents Jesus Christ's body given for you, broken for you on the cross in your place. The cup of juice represents his blood shed for you. But your coming forward to take this meal is ultimately us being told by God, it's not about you. And all of this instruction now is that you get to do this and to find more joy and satisfaction in me, the one who made you and has your best in mind. There's a gluten-free option in the back. And if you're new here, we normally just kind of funnel down the center and head this way. And there'll be individuals on the left and the right here who would love to pray for you. In light of anything from this message or anything going on in your life, those prayer requests are always confidential, and we're happy to do so as a church. Let's pray. Father, thanks for your word, which always has something better to say to us, especially in the context of instruction. Your word is always telling us, you know, at the end of the day, we are not great children. In fact, it's so difficult for children to even obey parents, and we all are those children. And for parents, it's so difficult to raise our kids in the instruction of the Lord. And for being an employee or an employer, it's impossible to actually do these things perfectly. And yet hearing it's not about us is the best news in the universe, that it is ultimately about Jesus, the one who did these things perfectly for us and who is now alive and in us and are trusting you and your saving act. Help us to receive now this bread, this wine, which speaks a better word than anything that we can hear from the world, than anything that we can hear from our own hearts, the word of your grace to us, that it is your finished work, not anything that we do that defines us. And may we sing back to you the good news of the gospel with glad hearts as we hear more and more the glad instruction that comes from the God who died for us. In Jesus' name, amen.